gather up the stars and the robins that sing merrily.
Sir, I write in response to your article in the Echo concerning the mysterious disappearance of Mr. William Cantello 50 years ago. As a child, I was a resident of Southampton, living with my family in the mahogany cottages opposite the Old Tower Inn, Barget Street. William Cantello was the landlord of this pub, which was popular with many of the ship's workers employed by him. My father often enjoyed a pint or two of ale there. I must have been about 6 years old on June 7th, 1880, the day I wish to tell you about. That fateful Saturday afternoon, my mother had been particularly busy and had sent me on several little errands to the grocer's to get a bit of mutton for tea and to return some laundry to a customer. As I passed the pub, which was closed, I heard something that sounded like rapid gunshots, though I'm sure at the time I didn't know what they were. Being an inquisitive child, I tried to peer through the window but could see nothing. The main door was locked, but there was a door around the side of the building which was ajar. I pushed it and found myself at the top of the stairs to the cellar. Now I could hear the explosive sounds reverberating around the space below, and my nostrils were filled with an acrid smell. Irresistibly drawn, I crept down the stairs into the darkness. As I reached the bottom, my eyes grew accustomed to the dim, smoky light. I could see the shapes of three men crouched around a huge contraption. Then, rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat! The explosive sounds nearly knocked me off my feet, and, terrified, I screamed. One of the men, it was Mr. Cantello himself, raced towards me. "What the devil are you doing down here, child?" I stood frozen in terror. He grabbed my wrist and started to drag me to the stairs, scolding me all the while. Then, suddenly, he stopped and knelt down, bringing his face close to mine. Oh, I thought my life was about to end. "Wait a bit. You're Dewey's little girl, aren't you?" I could only nod. "Then you're a clever little thing, aren't you?" He dug in his pocket and held out his hand. "Here's sixpence. It's all yours, if you promise not to breathe a word of what you've seen." "Do you promise?" What could I say, even if I could have mustered up the courage to speak? Sixpence was untold wealth. I kept my secret. And the explosions from under the pub continued every Saturday afternoon until Mr. Cantello left for another of his business trips. And we never saw him again. And that's when I learned that I was one of the first people to see his Maxim gun. Yours faithfully, Miss A.T. Dewey, Ashurst, Hampshire.
My sons, I write to you full of excitement. Some may say that the pen is mightier than the sword. However, I have just completed work on what I believe to be the mightiest instrument of them all. That's right. Our rapid recall gun is complete. A truly formidable weapon that I'm certain will make our fortune. Write like yourself, Willie. They'll never believe you if you don't write like yourself. I must thank you for all your work in this venture. We have proved that many hands indeed make light work. Yes. Better. Even of a complicated and, I believe, revolutionary machine. These past years have been a treasure trove of discovery, but I feel it is time for me to take some time away from the workshop. I need fresh air, away from the smoke and constant whirring of cogs that has begun to overtake my mind. Who's there? Is there someone there? I plan to take the instrument and enjoy a 3-month sabbatical in Europe. Who knows? Perhaps I'll find our first buyer. Berlin, I think. Berlin. The city of Berlin, 6,000 tons. It's got electric lights, Willie. Remember those? These ships are modern. Leviathans conquering the waters, not... The city of Richmond, 5,000 tons. The city of Chester, 5,000 tons. The city of Boston, 6,000 tons. Disappeared. Simply disappeared in the waves. The waves. Those mighty terrifying waves. 177 died. 8 days on the water. 8 days, Willie, just 8 days. Shh, listen. Hello? It's time, Willie. Time. Time waits for no man. Lost time is never found again. The two most powerful warriors are patience and time. I urge you to come to the workshop as soon as possible to help me pack the invention safely for my journey. Liverpool first and then... Who's there? Who is there? Jack. Bill. I can hear you moving in the darkness. In the smoke. And to bid me goodbye for these next months. Don't worry. I'll return soon and, mark my words, we'll be a rich family. Your father, William Cantelow.
My dearest John and William, first of all, let me apologise for the poor composition of this letter. I'm writing in haste, as I feel it is important I relay this information to you as soon as possible. I trust you found it in the old hiding place. It made me nostalgic for our antics of your childhood. Those days are far behind us now. I know you have shared my concern for your father's whereabouts as the weeks have turned to months, and the months have continued to pass. We have each assured the others in turn that this is just another of his adventures, and he'll return to the old tower soon enough. Tail between his legs again, as you said, Jay. The thing is, I have had some news. Mr. Percy from the National Provincial wasn't able to discuss your father's banking affairs in depth, but as he explained, had expected him home after 3 months, and it's double that now, he felt permitted to disclose the following. A large sum of money has been, in his words, transferred from the bank account. Now, you both know as well as I that your father had plans for the contents of those three cases, and that he was enormously proud of the work that had gone into the construction of what lay within them. You also know he wouldn't have made any sort of a deal that would incur an outlay of that kind without consulting you. I would also say and me, but we all know from experience that that is not entirely true. In truth, I am quite panicked to commit my initial thoughts to paper and ink in case that makes them real, but I fear there are some truths to face. Oh, my precious boys, I worry your father is dead. I worry he is dead and gone, and there was some expense for a funeral. I fear he was all alone, and either no one knew of us or knew of a way to reach us. It is a thought that sits uneasily with me. Not only him being alone, but not having his wishes met. Knowing him as we do, he would have been appalled by a stranger in a cassock singing, "Hold thou thy cross before my closing eyes." He'd never have let them close the box. Yet the fact remains, the monies were moved 3 months ago. There is much to discuss, and I will need your logical minds to unpuzzle this perplexing situation we find ourselves in. Let us come together this evening. We will decide what ought to be done next. With all love, as always and forever, Ma.
Dear sir, I hope this letter finds you well. Forgive me if I ramble, but I have never before required the services of a private investigator and hope to never be in need of one again. Some of the information detailed in this letter is of a sensitive nature, but my brother and I are at a loss and do not know where else to turn. I trust we can rely on your discretion. My name is William Cantelope Jr., a name for my father, an accomplished engineer. It is of him and his whereabouts that I reach out to you now. My father is a gifted man, a talented musician and respected businessman, but above all else, he is an inventor. As I'm sure you're aware, the need to protect one's inventions from competitors is of the utmost importance. To this end, my brother and I were the only people privy to our father's latest project, the creation of what we believe to be the first rapid recall gun. This has been a project long in the making, requiring of us all a level of secrecy and hard work that has taken its toll. However, the creation of such a weapon is of huge importance and therefore has always felt worth the sacrifice. Upon its completion, our father left for Europe to begin the promotion of this remarkable creation. The nature of the invention, a weapon of such power, is of course a hotly sought-after prize worth an enormous amount to its creator. On top of this, our father brought with him a not inconsiderable sum of money to cover his costs. We believed this to be a wise investment in all of our futures. He has now been gone more than 6 months. And whilst he is no stranger to longer absences, this is by far the longest. We have begun to fear for his safety. So we turn to you, in the hope that you find him safe and well, and merely waylaid with our invention. The alternatives are too horrible to contemplate. Yours, in hope, William Cantelope Jr.
My dearest brothers, I have barely had time to relight the fire and have sat down at my desk, hat on head and coat still buttoned, so that I may quickly write to you of our present predicament. I have now returned from my meeting with our man on the case, a disagreeable sort of fellow if ever there was one. I met our man at the port. I wished for your presence, but of course you are right. You mustn't be seen to be escalating the matter, especially after the nastiness caused by going to the papers. At that hour, the place was sordid. Laughter of the drunken not yet been to bed, creatures of the night rolling out of the fog. One wretched woman apprehended me. You only work here if you're a good girl. Are you? Good. I hurried my step, but she followed me on. Only gotta be looked after to be good. Mine don't beat ya, unless you cheat him. I wondered whether I had chosen right in not telling Stanley, but our man was so insistent that I came alone. Needless to say, I did not perish, nor fall prey to any lascivious intentions, as I write you presently to tell you this. Our father did not, as he told us, leave for Europe, but for America. Once there, a sum of £1,500 was transferred from his account at the National Provincial. But where, and to whom, our man does not know. The bank is out of pocket, and the records have disappeared, much like our beloved father. I suspect you are now battling with the most dreadful conclusions of fraud, of theft of birthright, but I must call on you to be cautious. After all, a little learning is a dangerous thing. Wasn't that in one of Father's dainty books? If you must bear forward on your present course, know that I do not intend to put my person in harm's way again. I pray for Father, as I pray for you both, and ask God to restore you together. Your devoted sister, Doreen.
Since the first proto-human raised his spear in anger, and in his brutish rage hurled it toward his foe, the conduct of ranged warfare has been bound by one unyielding rule, namely that once he has loosed his shot, be it spear, arrow, or a modern bullet, he must then prepare anew, and in doing so, make himself vulnerable to reprisals. That rule, for so many centuries as unshakable as the rhythm of the tides, is now to be challenged by a new American invention, a mechanical recoil gun known as the Maxim gun. Students of modern warfare may note that mechanical recoil guns, such as the Gatling or Nordenfeld, are already in common use among the great powers. Hiram Maxim, the inventor of the new weapon, had the following to say on the subject.
My invention is to the Gatling as the steamship was to the galleon. Both have ruled the seas, but who would sensibly set sail on a galleon today?
Diligent readers may recall that Maxim, no stranger to controversy, is currently embroiled in a legal dispute with fellow American Thomas Edison over the origination of the carbon filament bulb. Edison's patent was last year ruled invalid by the U.S. Patent Office, not, though, on the grounds of its similarity to Maxim's creation, but that of a Mr. William E. Sawyer. Maxim, 44, formerly of Maine, Massachusetts, has settled in Norwood, London, along with his wife, Sarah. The Maxim gun is slated to undergo military inspection in Salisbury on Friday.
London, June 3rd, 1881. Dear Miss Haynes, though I hesitate in my polite use of dear, as I regret to say that I hauled you about as dear as a bad rash. I have struggled to pen this letter. What does one say to the woman, or, in my case, the women, who are determined to become the next Mrs. Maxim? Do I point to his children, both born of myself and of the young Helen Layton, and ask that you respect that they need a father? Perhaps it would behoove me to remind you that he is several decades your senior, and surely you could find another wealthy man who piques your youthful interest. Or with telling you that he is married, not merely to me, but I suspect to Miss Layton as well, cause you to pause in your decision? I am inclined to believe that you know this already. Have you let your feelings for my husband, or perhaps his wealth, cloud your judgment? Is there nothing to be said for the sisterhood that is one of the only sources of strength we have as women? I have seen you with Hiram. Your beauty is beyond compare, with your ivory skin and auburn hair. You flirt mercilessly, however, which does not become you. That said, I am older. My beauty faded, and I cannot compete with you, Sarah. May I call you Sarah? Certainly you cannot disallow me this bit of familiarity under the circumstances. We are practically united in the flesh ourselves, are we not? I can easily understand how you can easily take my husband, but you do not know what he means to me, Sarah. It does not suit a woman of my status to do so, but I feel the only thing left is to implore you. No. Implore is not a strong enough sentiment.
Mama, someone is here to see you.
Who is it, please, my darling?
She would not give me her card, but she said her name is Miss Layton and that you would want to see her and that it is urgent.
Please have Miss Bennet tell her I'm unwell, Adelaide.
Are you unwell, Mama? Shall I bring you something to cheer you up?
No, darling. I'll be fine. I'm just not up to visitors.
But she has the sweetest baby.
Please, Addie. Have her sent away. Ask Miss Bennet. You stay away from her.
But... Yes, Mama.
My dear darling, I hope that you never have to know of the pain your father has caused. Implore is not a strong enough sentiment. Indeed. Do you know who is sitting in my front room, Sarah? Have you any idea the pain that you and women like you can cause? I feel, Sarah, that I have no choice. I am begging of you. Please do not take my man. Despite his wandering gaze and insistent dalliance, he is the only one for me. My happiness depends on you. Yours, Louisa Budden Maxim.
Dearest mother, and darling sister, sorry, it has been so long since my last letter. I hope you are both keeping well. I write this somewhat apprehensively, as I have news to tell you that is at once astounding and utterly peculiar. I'm sure that it will amaze you, and fear it may be deeply upsetting. Yet I feel utterly compelled by the bonds we share as a family to spare no detail of the strange events that have recently beset my brother and I. Just a few days ago, after breakfast, we were perusing the daily papers, as has become our habit since moving to London, when Billy showed me an article that had fairly leapt out of the page at him. The subject was the remarkable invention of an automatic rapid-firing gun so reminiscent of our father's rapid recall gun that we were both instantly convinced and remain completely so that it is indeed the very same. The marvellous weapon that our father designed and that the three of us spent so many hours getting to work was pictured right there before us, in the pages of the national newspaper. Could this possibly be a coincidence? We felt sure it could not. And yet, it also did not seem that this was the result of some leakage of our secret from anyone in Southampton, for the paper described it as the creation of an American inventor, one Hiram Maxim, from Boston, and recently arrived in London looking for buyers for what he calls his Maxim gun. The paper carried a portrait of this American, which Billy had paid little attention to, so shocked was he to have stumbled across our gun. When at last we did, however, study the man in the photograph, the strange coincidence seemed suddenly not so strange at all. For Hiram Maxim was revealed to be none other than our father, returned not from Europe where he told us he was bound, but from America, thus confirming a suggestion we have all heard before, that he had travelled to that new world. To think that all this time we had imagined him lost, or dead, or worse, when in fact he had been taking advantage of the freedom of American society to reinvent himself as Hiram Maxim, before hopping aboard a boat back to London. Perhaps he believes his concocted story of Bostonian roots, and the arrival in Britain of an American genius will better help him find buyers for his gun, and judging by the newspaper's response in this, he may be right. Our rapid recall gun is now the Maxim gun, and I wonder now if I don't remember our father using that name himself, though my brain is somewhat scrambled in this respect right now. Do either of you recall having heard it? In any case, and though I am sorry for the pain it must cause you to read this, the resemblance of that man to our father is unmistakable, and Billy and I are in no doubt that it is he. I must confess that after such a torrid start to the day, we found ourselves in need of an early visit to the club, where we fell into quite circular conversations of how best to deal with this revelation, and if indeed anything would be served by dealing with it at all. We kept at it until we were quite exhausted, and had consumed perhaps a little more whiskey than is wise, though under the circumstances I'm sure you will forgive us, for our nerves were somewhat frayed. And though we deliberated long and hard, we found ourselves completely agreed that we should not let the matter rest, and that we must, with urgency, seek our father out and confront him. Of course, we had no idea how this could be achieved, yet we felt determined and somehow certain of success. Perhaps we felt then that Lady Luck was on our side, for over breakfast the next morning, as we studied the article once more, we realised it told us where he was going to be later the very same day. The Maxim gun was to be inspected by military brass on Friday, in the vicinity of Salisbury. And its inventor was taking the train down the evening before, meaning he would be travelling from Waterloo Station sometime on Thursday afternoon. It was already Thursday morning when we read this, so we hurried to finish our breakfast and to get to the station, not only to ascertain the time of the Salisbury train's departure, but also to see how we could best position ourselves so as to be sure of not missing any passenger as they arrived to board the train. I won't bore you with the details of our waiting, which seemed endless. Suffice to say, we were ready when he came. And we watched him walk from the entrance steps across the hall. He seemed to have so much the gait and bearing of our missing father that we almost paused too long. But just in time, we fell in step behind him as he neared the train and, at a moment spontaneously arrived at, called in unison, "Father!" to his back. He turned at once, addressing us quite affably, saying, "Well, boys, what can I do for you?" I was momentarily taken aback as he spoke with a Yankee twang, but by his voice and the manner of address, I am still sure it was he. "Come and see Mother," said Billy, before I could think of anything at all. But any hope of a reply was forlorn, as at that moment the train started to pull away and our father swiftly turning and leaping aboard, leaving us with no answer at all. So it seems that Lady Luck has deserted us for now, or at the very least has decided to toy with us. Billy and I have spent the afternoon discussing what to do. And suppose we will try, through our contacts at the club and any contacts we can make at the press, to discover where in London he is staying. And for now, I agree to write to you both on our behalves, to share with you both the story of our strange encounter and the remarkable news that precipitated it. We felt we must inform you of every detail, if only to be open with you about things you deserve to know. Please forgive us for the anguish this brings to your hearts. But also, please inform us of anything you can think of that will aid us in our efforts to confront the man who made us. Write soon, and tell us what you can. With love, we remain your devoted sons and brothers, Jack and Billy.
Dearest Dory, my darling friend, I write to you in a state of acute distress. I have just now returned from a chance meeting with your neighbour, Mr. Dewey. I had not seen him since the Higginbottom's garden party last year, when he unfortunately dropped jam on Lady Higginbottom's silk chaise. Well, not 2 minutes into my visit, he divulged what he thought to be no more than an intriguing piece of gossip. Mr. Dewey was taking the air on the Esplanade but a week ago, and he saw a familiar face, one that had not been seen around these parts for over a year. It called out to the man, who instinctively turned around when hailed by name, but swiftly turned back and disappeared into the crowd near the Botanical Garden, and would not respond to Mr. Dewey's repeated attempts to attract his attention. My dear, the name Mr. Dewey called was Mr. Cantelow, your father. I asked him if he was quite sure it was Mr. Cantelow he had seen. He was adamant, my dear. Mr. Dewey may be careless with a condiment, but I believe him to be as honest and trustworthy a fellow as you would ever hope to meet. I quickly excused myself and rushed home to inform you of this most unsettling sighting. It is said that Hiram Maxim has a flair for brain-sucking, and is much interested in inventors' ideas. If your suspicions are correct, and your father is resurrected as Hiram Maxim, and is currently roaming the streets of Southampton, I would lay my good name on the suspicion he is looking for his next kind-hearted fool to swindle. Papa has worked so hard on his design for the propeller blade that will one day bear his name. I have forbidden the staff to allow this man admittance to the house. But I fear for what may happen if Papa were to meet Maxim at a place where I cannot be by his side. He is a trusting soul, and loves nothing more than to wax lyrical to anyone who shows the slightest interest in his niche area of expertise, especially after a glass or two of port. Help me, my sweet Dory. How can I prevent this devil from purloining my father's legacy? Yours in anguish, Emma.
Brother, various reports regarding yourself and your actions have given me great cause for concern. I was recently visited by a young gentleman whom I had never met, who remarked, "You've greatly improved since last we met, Hiram." I assured the young gentleman that we had never met, and that he must have me mistaken with another, a common error since I have been in London, England. He went on to tell me that the gentleman he had met told him his name was Hiram Stevens Maxim, born in Sangerville, Maine. I was taken aback that he could have such accurate personal information. He went on to describe the man he had met, and obviously was very sorry for any offence he had caused. As you well know, I have been in London for the past few years. I haven't stepped foot on American soil, and as much as I am sure I would enjoy it, I have never been to Chicago. Apparently that's where the young gentleman met me. Imagine my surprise when I read in a newspaper recently that I had not only been lecturing in the States, but bragging about my inventions, specifically about my guns. I have never been a man to brag about anything in my life. My guns speak for themselves. My inventions always have. Stealing is something I have always detested in a man, and stealing my identity is lower than you've ever stooped before. These antics are akin to those of Thomas Edison in taking credit for my work, begging the question as to whether you're hoping to emulate his unapologetic fiendishness. Isaac, you may think it is hilarious to have a doppelganger. I, however, do not. You always were my sneaky younger brother, living in my shadow. However, if you do not cease pretending to be me and live out your own life, I shall have to involve the authorities. Take this as a final warning, and one I will have no hesitation in escalating to the police, both in the United States and here in the United Kingdom, of which I am now a respected citizen. Regards, the real Hiram Stevens Maxim.
I'm sure they don't know. I think of them as the mice. Scratch, scratch, scratch. And they get everywhere. I cannot bear people knocking on doors. Not ever. Not since Albert. I insist they just scratch lightly. Like mice.
Good morning, ma'am. May I remind Her Majesty of the knighthood for Mr. Maxim? If Her Majesty would write her customary letter.
Yes, thank you, Wilkins. My mouse-in-chief is more like a water rat, the company he keeps. What shall I write? Does it matter? Will I even be the one to dub Mr. Maxim a knight? Nearly a decade ago, that war caused untold misery for the people, and in the name of obedience to the sovereign. To me, the sovereign called to obedience to a higher power, to whom I shall very soon give my account.
When he asks me why I chose to honour the inventor of a means of mechanised human slaughter, what will be my reply? This gun bearing its inventor's name will also cause untold misery. Are we to leave our sons such a legacy? I have a woman's mind for peace. Yet the mice make me choose war. They nibble away until I have no choice. Enough, Vicky. Duty. My dear Mr. Maxim, it is our royal pleasure to confer upon you the title of Knight Bachelor in recognition of your services.
1st December, 1924. To Romaine Dennison of New York. I am writing to inform you that your father has died. Your father. Such a familial term for someone so unfamiliar. I wonder what this news does to you. You can't have a memory of him, but the little memories his other children have haven't diminished the awe with which they speak of him. Right. Books about him, name their own children after him, and even follow in his footsteps. Do you ever think of him? It's clear to me now that he thought of you. I had no idea he thought of you. It may come as something of a surprise to hear that you were to inherit from his estate. Certainly came as a surprise to me, but perhaps it shouldn't, since I know above all others the double life your father, Sir Hiram Maxim, was capable of leading. Did he communicate with you? Perhaps you know more than I. I knew of his marriage to your mother. Your mother knew of his marriage to his first wife, although that didn't stop her like it didn't stop me. I now wonder, were there more? 4,000 pounds to the daughter he abandoned in another life. I wonder what your mother said of your father when you asked. I mean, I'm sure you asked. Let me tell you what I know. Your father was obsessive about everything. He pursued a project with his whole soul, be it an invention, a woman, money, or recognition. He was like steel in his determination and resolve. Everyone else, everything else, wife, child, rival, be damned. Not that he believed in damnation. No religion at his funeral to make sure of it. What else? Your father liked to travel. In Europe, mostly. Have you traveled outside of New York? Your father loved Vienna. And about the time he met your mother, or perhaps in fleeing your mother, he traveled there, where someone set him on his path. They said, if you want to make a pile of money, invent something that will enable these Europeans to cut each other's throats with greater facility. A new obsession was born. I read in the newspaper just last week that our latest drawn-out fight, the one the newspapers are calling the Battle of the Somme, has come to an end. Months of killing and the battle has just fizzled out. No one left to kill. I wonder how many of those men were killed by the gun he invented. The gun that made us rich. The gun that made you this money that will no doubt transform the last years of your life. He had a heart attack. He was 76. You have one brother and two older sisters that I know of. They will grieve for their Maxim. I will grieve for mine. I wonder, will you grieve for yours at all? With my sympathy, should you need it, Lady Sarah Maxim.
the wonderful Miss Dewey, Ashurst, Hampshire. I was so gratified to receive your letter, dated the 23rd of September 1930, and thrilled to read the contents. Your first-hand information about William Cantelope proved to be vital to my latest Occasional Notes column, which will be finalised and published next week with the title An Unsolved Mystery. In my years as a journalist, I have never come across such a head-scratcher. A mystery that has captivated my mind since I first moved to Southampton from London in 1913. Indeed, this true tale would be better served on the stage of the Old Grand Theatre rather than in the sheets of the Echo. As I hope my readers are aware, I will not print a fact unless I have the ability to stake my reputation on its validity. Therefore, I am unable to print a conclusion that I cannot find. I have combed through all the details that there are to be found, and yet, sadly, I am undone. William Cantelope and Hiram Maxim, one and the same, or akin to the point of deceiving family? And if family, why not bank clerks, travel officials, and lecture halls? The same age, same appearance, same invention. There is documented evidence of Mr. Maxim's life earlier than Mr. Cantelope's disappearance in 1880. There is anecdotal evidence that William Cantelope travelled for months away at a time. Did the same man lead a double life, fooling four women in marriage and parenthood? There is photographic evidence for William Cantelope inventing an identical gun to the Maxim gun before the 1884 article in the Echo, which declared Maxim as the inventor. Indeed, what else had your six-year-old self seen other than proof of his gun? Did a man whose life ended 6 years ago, one of the wealthiest men in the country, further, a knight of the realm, commit murder and plagiarise so successfully? I couldn't allow the Southern Daily Echo's pages to be used to prefer such a claim. Lady Sarah Maxim is, of course, still alive, but I may be permitted in this private correspondence to you. And then there is the simple detail that William Cantelope carried a small book of quotes everywhere, and every day as he tinkered with his secret invention, which he himself called his Maxim book. Perhaps you saw it, sticking out of a pocket, or perhaps your father was offered wisdom from it as he supped on his ale in the old tower. Would there be a better name to choose if he were to reinvent himself than Maxim? A gun, a disappearance, a resurrection, and a knight. Fit for the old grand indeed. Yet if I were present in my role as critic on opening night, my review may simply be, the story strains credulity. You were there, Miss Dewey. You were there, skirting the walls of the old Tower Inn Hotel. Oh, if only those walls could talk, the clandestine truth would be laid bare. Alas, we are ever left to grope in the smoke and the dark. Your grateful servant, E. Mitchell, Townsman.
You've been listening to Audio Logs by Actors Creative Team. Scene 1, performed by Kerry Gifford, written by Pamela Hall. Scene 2, performed by Andrew Cullum, written by Rosa Garland and Andrew Chevalier. Scene 3, performed by Anna Friend, written by Josephine Arden. Scene 4, performed by Jonathan Saunders, written by Jessica Dennis. Scene 5, performed by Josephine Arden, written by Alice Robinson. Scene 6, performed by Alice Robinson, written by Jonathan Saunders. Scene 7, performed by Jessica Dennis, written by Kristen Duffy. Scene 8, performed by Andrew Chevalier, written by Noel Lebon. Scene 9, performed by Nicola Woolley, written by Kerry Gifford. Scene 10, performed by Noel Lebon, written by Nicola Woolley. Scene 11, performed by Pamela Hall, written by Andrew Cullum. Scene 12, performed by Kristen Duffy, written by Andrew Chevalier. And Scene 13, performed by Rosa Garland, written by Andrew Chevalier.